Colonel Michael Dmitri Villefort.
I've seen this brigade intelligence officer as the 6th Infantry Brigade fought its way down to relieve the garrison in Kohima. And once we had established a way in, I went up into the garrison as staff officer to the acting brigade commander in the hill. It was an interesting experience. We had been supplied, of course, by parachute, and a lot of the parachute silks we used to decorate and make more habitable the dugouts in which we lived.
So I was wondering if you'd be good enough to explain what had happened in Kohima. Of course, this is related very much to Imphal as well, isn't it?
Well, before you
arrived.
Yes, well, the Kohima garrison had been completely surrounded by the Japanese, as had the Imphal garrison some few miles to the south. And so they were both cut off. Imphal was a much bigger garrison than Kohima was. And we had to really fight our way into Kohima to help get the Royal West Kents and other defenders out of there. Even as we'd fought our way in, we had a great deal of trouble in subduing the whole place, because the Japanese, who were only a matter of 40, 50 yards away in many places, were still very tenacious. And in the same way as in Arakan the year before, they would happily attack or mortar or grenade their own positions, which were very well dug in with supporting fire. Well, here I was in this brigade headquarters, and one of my jobs was to keep supplies arriving and being distributed to the soldiers in Kohima. As I say, most of our stuff came by parachute at that time, including our water. And the water was so scarce, we were restricted to, I think it was, one or two pints per day per person. And we were actually forbidden to wash and shave for all the time we were there, such as waters we had being needed for drinking and cooking. And one day an Indian battalion arrived in the perimeter to relieve one of the existing units, and I went off to see them, see how they were getting on. And I was amazed to be met by the commanding officer, who said, "Come along, old boy, come and have a cup of coffee," and produce their equivalent of a mess. And he was walking about wearing an ordinary cloth cap with an orderly walking behind him carrying his equipment for him. I have to say that shortly afterwards he was killed by the Japanese. But I asked him if there was anything he wanted. He said, "No, thank you, I've got everything." Then in the night he rang me up and said, "Oh, do you think you let us have some ammunition, old boy? We haven't brought any." I think he meant reserve ammunition, but even so, it was a bit snap happy, I felt, that little lot. Well, now, during the later stages of the Battle of Kohima, it was decided that 6th Brigade should do a right hook round a hill called Aradira Spur to try and get behind the Japanese and come back onto the road going south to Imphal. At this time, we had a brigadier in command, Brigadier John Shapland, another very brave man who won the Military Cross in the First World War, but who was a gunner and didn't appear really to understand infantry tactics at all. And his orders were to the Royal Berkshires to go ahead through a jungle track up this spur to bivouac or to dig in for the night and to be followed by the Royal Welsh Fusiliers, but that his instructions were that as the Royal Welsh Fusiliers arrived, so the Royal Berkshires should move out, so that you had a sort of transit period, which was quite contrary to infantry training, whereby the ones moving out would not move until the ones coming in had established a firm base. And the battalion commanders were very upset about this proposal and tried to get it overturned, but without any success whatsoever. So, as the Royal Welsh Fusiliers were moving in, the brigadier said to me, come on, we'll go up and establish our forward headquarters up there. So he and I went off and were inside the Royal Welsh Fusiliers perimeter at a time when the Japanese from higher up the hill put an attack on the Royal Welsh. Royal Marches by this time more or less moved on. And the fact is that the battalion Royal Welsh Fusiliers, to my shame, was routed by the Japanese, probably only a company strong, probably only armed with 2-inch mortars against our 3-inch mortars. And they ran down the hill. During this time, the second in command, Johnny Owen, was killed. He was a very popular man. He'd been a regular other rank, had been a warrant officer in Dunkirk, had risen to become major and second in command, or at least acting second in command of the battalion. And there was a certain amount of shambles going on at this time. And Colonel Braithwaite said to Brigadier Chaplin, I think you should go. He said, go and leave my Royal Welsh Fusiliers. No, I can't do that. And then he was wounded in the neck by the Japanese. And at this time, there were very few Royal Welsh Fusiliers left. And I more or less carried Brigadier Chaplin down the hill and got him to the bottom and handed him over to medical attention.
And did you place yourself in danger in going to rescue him?
Oh, he was sitting side by side in a dugout. I was as much danger as he, but more lucky. That night, Colonel Braithwaite was relieved of command of the battalion, and his recommendation for a DSO, we understood, was torn up. The trouble was that earlier on, some of the officers of the battalion had been to see the brigadier and complained about the fact that they weren't getting enough sleep and rest under Colonel Braithwaite, who would make them stand to all night, and they were absolutely exhausted and like zombies. And asked for him to be relieved, but it was reckoned to be too late in the day to do that with this attack going in, and so it stood. But anyway, Garnet Braithwaite then went. And in his place we got Colonel Jack Stocker, who was basically a South Wales borderer, but had been commanding the 7th Battalion of the Worcestershire Regiment in 2nd Division. A very good chap who came to us the following day, and I was brought back from brigade the day after that to become adjutant of the 1st Battalion.
Going back to Chaplin's, his wounding, and your rescue, I understand you brought him down the hill. You carried him, did you?
Well, he and I were both in the same slip trench or dugout when it happened, and we were standing beside each other when he got wounded. And when he finally agreed to go, I half carried, half supported him on his own feet as he went down the hill, slipping in the mud and the pouring rain as we went.
Conditions were bad at that time.
Conditions were very bad. It was pouring with rain, it was muddy. The hill was precipitous, we were surrounded by jungle, and also, I regret to say, by soldiers running away.
So what was morale like after that battle?
Imagine that morale in the battalion leading up to this disaster had been very severely eroded, and indeed the medical reports of the Army Medical Services make this perfectly clear. If I might quote from the volume 5 of their reports on psychiatric problems at Kohima, the report says this: one battalion of the RWF sustained 23% psychiatric casualties, while the corresponding figure for another battalion, the 7th Worcesters, was 1.6%. The reason for this was that the former battalion was commanded by an officer who was unpopular throughout the unit and who had failed to win the respect of his subordinates either as a tactician or as a man before the battle. And during battle, he failed in both roles, with the result that numbers of men broke down who should never have done so, and it was not so much a matter of individual breakdowns as of a wholesale loss of group morale, with numbers of anxious men turning back bewildered with feelings of hopeless apathy mixed with disgust at the lack of proper leadership.
So Jack Stocker had quite a task on his hands.
Jack Stocker and I, if I might say so, had quite a task on our hands.
It's because you were now adjutant.
I was adjutant, yes. Jack Stocker was from the South Wales Borderers, and therefore, I suppose, in a way, had a certain kinship with the Welsh and the Royal Welsh Fusiliers. Although, of course, by now the battalion was very much diluted by intakes from other units and other races, indeed. Jack, I remember pinning on the back of his shirt, or must have been a tunic, a Royal Welsh Fusiliers black flash, which he reckoned was one of the proudest things that happened to him. We both were very fond of certain music, and I had an old wind-up gramophone that I got in Calcutta sometime, and some very scratchy records. And our particular favourite was Bing Crosby and I think Mary Martin singing "Wait Till the Sun Shines, Nelly," and we sang that to each other absolutely interminably. He also brought me back from leave a penny whistle, which I used to play for him. He had a wife in Pune. I can't remember the circumstances why she happened to be there. He must have been soldiering abroad at the time. And he went on leave on occasion. And when the men were complaining about Mepocrine and it affecting their virility, he would come back and say, "Well, I am the only one amongst you who can guarantee that it does not have any such effect." We started, when we had time after this battle, we settled down at a place called Milestone 82 on the road to Imphal. By then the Imphal road had been opened, and although it was a question of fighting a series of small actions all down the road until the link-up was made, my battalion had no particular specific action which resulted in the link-up except contributing to what was going on all around us. But at Milestone 82, we settled down to a period of rehabilitation and retraining, and we got all sorts of reinforcements from here, there and everywhere. For example, they dismounted a whole column of Royal Army Service Corps transport people to send us as reinforcements. Fine, but they all had petrol feet and couldn't march. Then they sent us surplus stokers from the Navy and air crew from the Air Force. Fine, but they had rank in their own service higher than that of our private soldiers, and they were not allowed to drop pay. So our chaps weren't very bucked that people who didn't know their job were getting paid more than they were. So that, I suppose it worked, but it wasn't all that clever. As adjutant, I was able to find in my kit somewhere, I don't know how I had it with me, a regimental history, a Sam Brown belt, a regimental cane, and I used to give regimental history lectures in the jungle to newly joining officers from here, there and everywhere. I mounted a quarter guard in a proper regimental manner every day. I sent A Company guard off parade 3 times. I didn't pass their turnout. And we gradually rebuilt the morale of that unit until it became, as the psychiatric report says, a first-class fighting unit again.
And did it become cohesive with all these disparate elements in it?
Yeah, yes. I mean, as after Dunkirk, when we ingested all those Gloucestershires, people become regimentally attached and join in the esprit of the unit, which is such a credit to the system of regimental organisation which the British Army has, which would be destroyed if some politicians had their way. Well, at Milestone 82, this is what you're waiting for, we had our Wasby canteen. Wasby, the Women's Auxiliary Service, brackets Burma, brackets all for the small s, so they're usually written WASBIES, but they weren't. These women were, to my mind, quite remarkable. They were all what you might call gentlefolk who had been in India or Burma and had connections and relations there. And we had this canteen of 4 ladies sent to our division. And the division at that time was something like 18,000 people, if it had been up to strength. And here we were with 4 white women who were sent to my battalion to be looked after. What was I going to do? So I went to see them, and I spoke to Alison McLaren, who was the officer in charge of these 4 women, recently widowed from a husband, Duncan, who'd won the DSO with the King's Own Scottish Borderers, but still absolutely indomitable. And I said to her, I'm not going to put a barbed wire fence around you. I'll give you a telephone. If you get into trouble, you can ring me up. And that's what we did. We got a hut built for them. They had a fireplace in it. And these 4 girls, Alison McLaren, and her second-in-command was one Emma Pert. She is the wife of Brigadier Claude Pert, who was with the 17th Indian Division. And I think he was the only man ever allowed to stay overnight in their hut. And you can imagine the stories about what the soldiery found outside the window the following morning. Probably quite untrue, but there you go. The next after Emma was Corporal Audrey Butler, a quietish sort of girl. I don't really remember very much about her. And the baby of the unit was Doreen Sanders, who, unknown to us, had a secret fiancé in the gunners in the Arakan at that time, but we didn't. Their system of working was this. 2 of the girls would cook during the day, while the other 2 took out the produce that had been prepared the day before and took their mobile canteen all around the 18,000 soldiers of the 2nd Division. They were allowed right up to the front, or very nearly so, and they could go anywhere they liked. They had a British driver who was one of our soldiers. I'm told he was a driver 60 Thomas of the Royal Welsh Fusiliers. I can't say I remember him, but Doreen Sanders told me after the war that that was their driver. The sort of item that they used to do was to produce 100 pounds of fudge in a day. At times they had as much as 1,000 pounds of cakes on order, toilet necessities, stationery, and all sorts of oddments which men might need, they used to produce for them. They used to buy in bulk and take them down to their canteen around the division. Their takings amounted to as much as 9,000 rupees a day, and were never less than 800 rupees a day. At that time, a rupee was worth about 1 and 6 pence.
Did you ever meet Nin Taylor or Lois St. John?
No, I didn't. They were the headquarters people. Lynn Taylor, I don't think, ever came forward to us. But she was back at their headquarters, and I gather fighting very hard for them. No, I didn't. Because, again, unfortunately, rather like the Indian experience, I went on leave while they were with us. For the first time in the war, we were granted 14 days leave, and we were granted up to 14 days travelling to go with it. So I decided to get cold, really cold, and posted myself as adjutant back to our rear details in Ahmednagar to pick up, ostensibly to pick up warm clothing, and went on to Srinagar in Kashmir for my holidays. So that was very good.
But I you left the Wasps at that time?
The Wasps were already with us at that time, yes. But I left them in the tender care of whoever was taking answering for me until I got back again. Mm-hmm. And later, Doreen sent me a copy of a posting order I had written on the 11th of November 1944, saying that Second Lieutenant A. McLaren and Corporal D. Saunders, she got promoted by then apparently, will proceed on leave to Shillong on Monday the 13th by unit transport to Imphal, where they will emplane for Sylhet. To whom it may concern, will you please arrange every possible assistance be given this party in obtaining road accommodation, and the QM will issue rations as required. It's amusing to see that I wrote that as adjutant and all those years ago, and I'd forgotten all about it. But
how did the troops regard these?
Oh, women? Very well indeed. There was never any misbehaviour, or I'm sure there was a lot of gentle joking, but they appreciated a white woman to talk to and to look at and have, in the nicest sense, the word intercourse with.
Were they in danger? You know, would you say?
Not really. No, I mean, not in danger unless there happened to be some overlooked Japanese hiding up in the jungle who might take a pot shot. But why would he? It wouldn't do him any good. I don't think they were in real. Not with us. They weren't in real danger. I dare say, in some other parts of Burma, they might well have been. Might well have been. In fact, I know they were. I think reading reports of the Chinthe women who went to Akiab and so on, they were under fire from time to time, but not with us. Doreen,
did it cause many problems for you, though, having to look after a group of women?
Absolutely none. They looked after themselves. I told you I gave them a telephone. They never once used it to ring me up, as far as I know. Doreen wrote to me afterwards that she used to bring the money into my office every day. I looked so severe, but I don't remember doing that. However, we never had anything to be severe about with them. They were very good indeed. And in fact, she wrote at one time, Doreen Saunders wrote at one time, later we moved to our beautiful camp home at 82 Milestone, and a wonderful fireplace was built for us. Everyone was so good to us. And we tried to keep a low-key lifestyle. I always remember the low sound of singing starting up and the beautiful way the music grew to crescendo of glorious voices all around us on top of those hills with views of the river far, far below. I remember it so clearly, those Welshmen and their homesick voices, and once or twice we were invited to their concerts.
You heard a lot of that, I expect, you know, singing.
Oh, yes. I even once sang in the choir back in Wrexham days, but it rather foxed me because they all sang from so far, and I never learnt so far. I only sang from notation, which I wasn't very good at it.
Were their living conditions, you know, quite rough for women? As you say, they were gentle women. So were they living in relatively rough conditions, would you say, there was?
Well, with us at Milestone 82, they had a good hut, but they didn't always have a hut. They sometimes had tentage or whatever arrived for them. another account I have read concerning the Wasps house hunting in the almost roofless village of Kohima was no joke. This was before they came to us. But the worst experience was when they took over possession of an old Jap headquarters recently retaken by the Royal Scots. The bodies had been very hastily buried and the smell was appalling. Whatever life had in store for them, they just got on with it, slogging around the battalion sites through deep mud, radiating cheerfulness and fellowship, and accepting invitations to all messes, officers, NCOs and private soldiers. They make just one proviso on the social side. They won't go to more than three evenings, and a whole Sunday keeps them going for their new strenuous job.
Yes, I suspect they were in great demand socially, weren't they?
In as far as you can spread four women amongst 18,000 men, I suppose, yes. I think we probably had first call because we were closest. And I know my gramophone travelled up to their mess to play records. Not only Wait Till the Sun Shines Nearly, but the Ink Spots Paper Doll song is another favourite. And we had the odd little dance there. And I remember we had at least two farewell parties for them. I can't think why two. But I remember after the second one, the following morning, the first time in my life, the only thing I wanted for breakfast was gin.
Would that have been your only contact with the Wasbys?
Yes. My only contact, yes.
The supply situation, were you involved with that for the Wasbys? How they got their supplies of this cake and fudge and cigarettes?
Well, things like cigarettes, of course, cigarettes and razor blades and stationery, of course, they got from the Marquesio depots by travelling back to collect them or getting them brought forward. But the fudge and the cake and that sort of thing, they cooked themselves, along with buns and made their own tea. And they had very strict accounting rules, too, laid down by their own people. But it was nothing to do with us. It was their accounts, their supplies, and the only thing we did was to provide a driver for their vehicle.
Did you consider them part of the army?
I think I consider them part of the battalion. I mean, they wore uniform, they had soi-disant military rank.
And it made a difference, you think, to the men's morale
in women
there?
Oh, I certainly did. It's amusing that a year or so ago I had a Christmas card from Alison McLaren, who's up in Scotland now in a home there, and she must be not far off 90 if she's anything by now. And I forget what was happening in the world at large at the particular time, but she wrote in her Christmas card, "It's hard to have wars and we can't be part of it." I thought that was very indicative of the sort of spirit that they had.
Were there other women, apart from the Wasbys? You know, I was wondering
not
about
forward,
nursing.
No, not there was nurses, but I never saw any forward. There were some probably in Dimapur, but not further forward than that. And of course there were other women's services, like the WAC I, the WAAC brackets I, Women's Auxiliary Army Corps India. There were RINs, Women's Royal Auxiliary Naval Service, and I expect there were WAFs, I can't remember them, Women's Indian Auxiliary Air Force, but I don't remember anything about them. Red Cross, of course, and St. John, some of them joint personnel. I suppose the only other women one who came anywhere near us, and I don't remember seeing her myself, was Lady Mountbatten.
Kohima, what were the medical services like during the battle? You know, one thinks of the number of wounded and how on earth you coped, bearing in mind there was no sort of roads in and out.
Part of the Kohima garrison was known as IGS Spur, Indian General Hospital Spur, and it's where the original garrison had the regimental aid post, which really consisted of slit trenches and one thing or another. And where their doctors operated, literally, if when need be, and looked after their wounded. But when the Royal Wisconsin was still in occupation of Kohima, this regimental aid post was frequently under shelling or grenade or water attack by the Japs.